speaks, or generally he'll get up and start his speech and then say, I ask unanimous consent to revise and extend my remarks. And it all appears as a speech, see. But nobody wants to hear it. And he doesn't want to bother to say it, so, but it goes in the record, see. So that nobody is there for special orders unless there's something special. But in this case, pretty near the whole house came over back on the floor of the house, because they knew Watts was going to talk about this. And it was, they asked him questions, and they stayed there for an hour, and as that hour was up, and some guy got up, and I asked unanimous consent the gentleman be allowed to speak for 30 minutes more. Now, that's the kind of a guy he wasn't, no Republican or Democrat to it. He was just a very able fella, mm-hmm. and a hell of a good speaker, with no demagogue. No flowery stuff at all, just facts. Stated very well, lucidly. Well.
What did he do for you in Congress, or you for him?
I never asked him to do anything, I don't think. I asked him, when I had the primary fight, I was reluctant to ask him because he was, I felt way above me. And I knew he and Stubby Cole knew each other pretty well. They'd been in there before I was there, so I said, Stubb, you think it'd be all right to ask Jim Wadsworth to give me a letter that I could pin on my folder for my primary fight? And he was sure. He said, you want me to speak to him? I said, yeah. He did speak to him, and Jim Wadsworth came around. He said, well, God, why didn't you tell me yourself? He said, you, naturally, anything I can do to help you, I want to. Of course. And I said, would you give me a letter? Sure. Of course I would. He gave me a hell of a good letter. I never used it, but he gave me one. I didn't use a lot of them. I got it.
How are the letters used in all this material?
Well, this primary, I was probably wrong, but Mark Antonio had used it, he told me, in a great shape in his primary fights down here. He puts your picture right in the middle, and what he said was, put the bullshit. They put these letters all around there, see. So I got quite a few letters from different people that the whole district of Bert Snell, and you know, Bert Snell was in my corner, and a lot of people like that. And I distributed those to every Republican, registered Republican. They were the only ones who could vote. And as Mark Antonio said, you don't scatter your shots that way, you go to just the ones that can vote. Mm-hmm. And it cost me quite a little money, but and it was probably wasn't worth it. As a matter of fact, down in Herkimer County, which I had then, the county chairman says, what do you think? I said to this, what do you think about this, Walt? Do you think that, oh, he says, one influence of both, all right, nice to do. And I said, well, what will it? And he was helping me with it. He said, you send them all for Herkimer County. I got our mailing list, their mailing machine here. We mail them all out for you, just to the registered Republicans. And he did. Address them, you know. The addresser graph went right through the machine. And I don't think it helped him. You know. As Walt said, he said the thing that helps is the workers on election day, they know that in each voting district, they know who's there, and if you've got 3-4 cars and 3-4 workers, they'll see that everyone votes. There, it's for you. Everyone get them, bring them to polls. He said that costs money, and that's what affects the vote. In a primary, especially.
Mm-hmm. Just who turned out?
Because nobody cares about a primary, the ordinary fellow, unless he's interested in politics. You take an ordinary primary fight, the only people to vote would be the workers that are paid to stay there that day. Mm-hmm. Unless they got relatives or families, they're old and told them.
Did being elected to Congress affect your regular life in Malone because you became a congressman, Kelvin? How did you change?
Oh, well, yeah. It was always.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of people, I suppose, were against me, but because they thought I maybe thought too much of myself or something. I don't think I ever did. But tried to, because it didn't make any difference, really.
Did you lose any friends that way?
Oh, I don't think a lot. Anybody, a lot of people that would come up to me speaking very nice to me. If I hadn't been a congressman, they wouldn't have done it. Now everybody in Main Street speaks to me. everybody anyway now, down the street. But it's astounding to me. He could just, of course, in Main Street now, it doesn't amount to much in compared to the whole congressional district, but I go down there and I'd say, hi. The fellow said, morning, Mr. Kilby.
Tape 7, September 7th, 1970.
I think easier as far as the work was concerned, but it wasn't as much fun for the reason, as I told you before, you made a lot of friendships at first. Everybody was nice and you wanted to make friends, and you did, and you went out of your way to make friends, and then those people would gradually move up to the Senate, or they wouldn't run, or they'd be sick, or they'd drive, get licked or something. So, and then you didn't make the effort to make friends with the new members. Mm-hmm. At least I didn't. Mm-hmm. And so your close friends kept narrowing down, see. So when I left there, well, there was only a few, well, the fellows on my committee and the new ones that came in that on the committee, of course, I tried to be friends with and get to know them. When I say get to friends, I mean get to know them so that you could work with them.
Mm-hmm. Were you one of the longest, you weren't among your colleagues, were there many others who were there as long as you were, do you think? There were a few that were longer. But
you the only thing I can tell you is that they give you a congressional tag for your car, and those tags are in the number down to one, see. The fellow's been there the longest is number one. Mm-hmm. Well, I had 29 out of 435. Mm-hmm. And of course, I was chairman of the New York delegation, the Republican delegation.
Mm-hmm. That goes pretty much by years in Congress?
Well, it did.
Chairman.
Generally, yeah. Mm-hmm. It doesn't always, but it did. And when I became chairman, when I first went there, Dan Reed and Dr. Crowther were the longest, and John Tabor was next. And I guess Jim Wadsworth, I forgot. But when I, in the delegation, there are different appointments. There's a chairman. Mm-hmm. There's a member of the member of committees. There's a member of the congressional committee. That's the committee that works to elect Congress, congressmen, see.
Mm-hmm.
Chairman of the Congressional Committee has got an awful lot of work to do because he sends out a lot of stuff and he takes care of publicity and tries to get to help any way he can, help all members of Congress, all Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And there was and there was a secretary. That'd be five things here. But when I went there, why, Dan Reed and Doc Crowther took them all. See, they just, they had a senior and they'd be chairman and member on the committee. Oh, and a policy committee. On the policy committee was another.
These are all officers in the delegation.
Yeah.
In New York State delegation.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So when I became chairman, I'd been on the policy committee, and I didn't want that anymore. Anyway, so when I became chairman, I told the delegation after they elected me chairman that I thought those offices ought to be spread around. And so I just was chairman, and then they elected somebody else for each of the other five offices.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What do the state delegations do in Congress?
Well, some of them are, of course, you want to remember, some delegations only consist of one man.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're by two or three. Mm-hmm. But the big ones, it depends an awful lot on their feelings on the matter and their what they've done in the past and how they want to operate. They can. It doesn't amount to an awful lot. But now you take the Texas delegation used to meet the Democrats. The Texas delegation used to meet every week. The Pennsylvania delegation, the Republican delegation, I think met every week. The New York delegation used to meet often, and I talked it over when I was chairman. I said, "Now," and I guess before that, for a few times, they kind of had an understanding when anybody wanted a meeting, we'd have a meeting, see. But there was no, wouldn't be much point in having a meeting and have everybody go there if there wasn't anything to talk about, see. But if anybody wanted to have a meeting, why, then we'd have a meeting.
What kind of things would you have meetings about?
Well, sometimes it was just social. And sometimes it was to talk over committees, appointments, or legislation, or how are we going to stand on this thing? If we could get a unanimous thing, well, they thought there'd be more power to this. A lot of delegations felt they'd have more power if they could vote as a unit, see?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we never could vote as a unit, that I remember of. And I don't think we made any attempt to. Mm-hmm. Because you had Javits there, and then you'd have Reed, Ogden Reed afterwards. They'd, a lot of them voted Lindsay. They always vote with the Democrats, nearly always. You always have some guy that would. This fellow Horton from Rochester, I don't remember his ever voting for the Republicans.
What did the rest of the Republicans feel about him for that reason?
Well, didn't think much of him. And a lot of things, he could have voted with us.
Mm-hmm. How many years were you head of the New York delegation?
I think it was only the last 2 years. Might have been the last four. I get it confused with the committee. I think it was the, might have been the last four. I guess it was the last 4 years.
Did you enjoy being head of that delegation?
Well, in a way, yeah. But it wasn't, didn't mean, there wasn't an awful lot of activity. Mm-hmm. I mean, you wouldn't have much to do, and it didn't amount to too much.
Mm-hmm. Was it hard to carry on your banking business here in Malone and be in Congress also?
Oh, I didn't try doing it here. When I was up here, I'd go down and talk things over with them, but I didn't.
You still retain presidency of the bank?
Up till the time we went into the, in with Watertown, and I was a vice president.
Mm-hmm. Was not considered a conflict of interest? Today it might be, but back then it wasn't?
Well, I don't think so. Everybody knew as a banker, you list yourself as a banker right in the thing. What is a conflict of interest?
I don't know. Today people usually think that.
Well, look. A lawyer lists himself as a lawyer and he goes on the Judiciary Committee. Is that a conflict of interest?
Well, if he's trying to practice.
A farmer goes on the Agricultural Committee. You've got to have somebody that knows something about their business. And I've had bills down there that I refused to vote on because I thought that there was a conflict in the committee.
So you went on to
but
the.
But you presume that everybody is honest. Mm-hmm. If they aren't honest, there's no making difference if there's a conflict or not.
Right.
And I found most everybody down there honest, regardless of how they looked or what they say about them in the paper, things like that.
Are the representatives very frank with each other? You know, open?
Off the
off the record, you know, when they're not being watched.
Oh, yes.
Right.
Most of them. Some of them are cagey and try to be. Most of them they're good guys. If they're good, honest, straight fellas, why, they know it. Yeah. But
What matters would the banking committee discuss?
Well, it's laid out. The parliamentarian generally assigns, the speaker assigns it, but the parliamentarian tells him where he thinks a bill ought to go. See. But the Banking Currency Committee has outlines like coinage and banking, of course, finances, housing because of the mortgage thing, and depends on the provisions of a bill. Sometimes you have a bill that one committee thinks they ought to have, another committee thinks they ought to have, and the speaker has to decide that. Or you might have a bill that's it's rare, but once in a while you have a bill assigned to a committee, and after they meet and go into provisions of the bill, they'll say, well, this shouldn't be in our committee, it should be in another one. That doesn't happen very often.
How aware were you of bills and things that were coming up in Congress outside your own committee?
Well, they announce a program for each week, see, what's going to come up as well as they can. And you're aware of that. But I never, myself, studied a bill until it came to floor. Because a great many of them you study on, and then they never come to floor. Mm-hmm. So I always thought it was just a waste of time.
Being on the Banking and Currency Committee demanded knowledge almost of the whole country, didn't it?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
Now, before you went on that committee in 1946, did you have a great deal of this knowledge, or did you have to gain it?
No, I had to gain it.
Mm-hmm. How long would you think it took you before you had a real grasp of...
Well, you're talking about it. You don't need a real grasp of... You get the provisions of the bill, and you know how that affects banks and how it affects the public. And you're trying to act in the public interest, and at the same time, you want the banks to be sound. You don't want the banks to lose money. I didn't. Mm-hmm. I didn't think it was in the public interest. So you just act there. You don't have to know the geography of the country to do that. So I knew the geography of the country. And by the way, you learn a lot of the geography of the country in the House because there's fellows there from every part of the country.
Did you know many of the Southern congressmen?
Oh, I know a lot of them. Mm-hmm. A lot of them.
Which area of the country did you find or feel has about the basic same interest as your area, your own congressional district? Were there?
Well, I'd say Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Any other?
Because cheese and milk. Oh, yes, they had. Be surprised, there's quite a dairy business in Florida. And there's, of course, in California. Pennsylvania, they all have dairy interests, but some of them very little. Vermont.
Did you find that the Southerners had any interest with us?
No, of course, the Southerners, people talk about them and write about them and all that. I thought, by and large, the Southerners were very able men. And a lot of them, they changed at the last few years, but a lot of the old timers there, they keep coming back, and they get to experience, and they get positions of influence, and I always found them very fair about anything having to do with my district. I might go to a fellow on the Rules Committee or something and say, I'd like to get this provision or that provision in the rule, and they were always, I always thought, very fair and very able. They didn't change as much, you see. These fly-by-nights, you get some screwball there from... I remember one fellow from Oregon came in there, and he was down there talking all the time. He didn't know what he was talking about, see. He was just a joke. Well, after one term, he's slicked. Well, that doesn't happen in the South. Didn't when I was there. They pick a good man, and generally speaking, they're good, honest fellows. One of the best men down there in Virginia, if you call that South, was Smith. Virginia was chairman of the Rules Committee eventually. And he was kind of the type like Wadsworth. He didn't, petty stuff didn't bulk with him at all, so he went after the big stuff. He didn't try to demagogue ever. He was sound, and had very high principles. Of course, he fought for Virginia, and sure, he should. That's where he came from. It was his district. And he fought for the South. Of course, they had an awful problem down there in the South, but on civil rights. People don't realize what those fellows were up against, a lot of them. But it's a strange thing that 90% of the riots for the Negroes took place in the North. There were riots down South, the Mount Ending Tall, until the last two or three years.
How did you see the civil rights controversy?
Well, I thought a lot of it was bunk, and a lot of it was for demagogues. In the first place, you had a civil rights bill come up down there. New York State passed a civil rights bill that was stronger than the one down there. And New York State and Harlem had more trouble with the Negroes than anybody else. So the civil rights bill in New York State didn't do as much good here. Also, you look back over the history of the Negroes 100 years ago and 75 years ago even. You had lynchings down South. You hadn't had a lynching in the South for years and years. You had more lynchings up North. Opened up, I remember, during the civil rights thing. People would get up, these Northerners that have a lot of Negroes in the district, and demagogue on it, just terrible, I thought. And I didn't think a civil rights bill, the provisions of it, would do any good. It didn't do any good in New York State, because everybody has the right to their own circle of friends. If they want to be friends with people, well, they want to be friends with them. If they don't, they don't, whether he's white or black or yellow or what. But you're not going to force anybody to take as a friend somebody that you don't like. And I thought the Negroes in this country had come up out of their so-called oppression, which makes me laugh. Now, there's one Southerner who got up and made a speech. He said the only one that are oppressed now in this country, the old-fashioned white Americans. Nobody wants that block of votes. He said, everybody's for the Negroes or for the Italians or for the Jews or somebody. And he said, the only one's forgotten, the only forgotten block is the old time white American settlers. And there was something to it, too. You never heard about demagoguing about them. But I remember very well one time on the civil rights bill, they got up and some Northerner got up and he showed this schoolhouse, see, in a district down in Alabama, say, I've forgotten the state. And it wasn't much of a schoolhouse. Didn't look like too much of a school. And here's the Negro school down here. And so on. Well, he got through talking. Somebody had given it to him. And he got through talking, and the next day, when they could find out about it, they had flown up the picture of that same Negro school, except it was really was a great, big, wonderful school. It was a different school, been rebuilt, see. This first guy didn't know it. And they had a better school than the white school, see. So they play on a lot of prejudices and a lot of stuff like that in the civil rights. I think most of it is bunk.
And what did you feel about the open housing legislation?
Well, I was always against public housing. Open house? What do you mean by open house?
They say that no covenant can be made in a neighborhood to exclude any person of any race or religion or nationality.
Well, I don't mind that, except, of course, you've got certain for instance, I know of a town up north, and the people, little settlement, the people in that settlement all own the settlement. They own all the houses in it. They know they pay taxes to the big township for schools. They don't have any to maintain any schools running. They've got a covenant that if anybody sells, and when they buy there, they know it. It's got to be approved by the rest. I don't see anything wrong with it.
Is this town in Canada or?
No, it's the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see anything wrong with it. When they buy it, they know that.
Why did you feel as you did about the public housing?
Well, I don't know. I'm probably too old-fashioned or something, but I couldn't see why the federal government should build a house for a man any more than they should pay his rent or anything else. And there was a fellow down there in Congress that explained it pretty well. He felt the same as I did. And he said in his town he knew of two fellows about the same age. One of them, and they had about the same income, worked about the same kind of a job. One of them saved his money, worked hard, worked overtime, picked up some secondhand lumber, bought a little lot, built extra hours, he built his house, and he had a house of his own. The other fella, he didn't work after hours, he drank all the liquor he wanted to, spend his money, didn't save anything or anything. So then the federal government comes along and he taxes this guy, this first fellow, to pay for the other fellow's house. Well, that's an extreme thing, but I didn't see any reason why the federal government, after all, the money that goes in this comes from the taxpayers. The federal government got manufacture money. And it comes from the taxpayers. And why they should go so far as to build a house for a fella, then why not feed him? No good, a bum that is no good, won't save his money, won't work or anything else, why build a house for him?
What bills did you sponsor while in Congress? Do you remember how were there many? Or?
Well, you don't really sponsor bills, many. You sponsor bills to make a name for yourself, but they don't amount to anything. I always had a Seaway bill in, for instance, because I'm distant. But you don't. The chairman of the committee, or the ranking man on the committee, they sponsor the bills if you want them passed, because. And they've been on the committee the longest, and they know more about the subject. But I've seen fellas, I don't know whether I told you this, but there was a fellow down there named Ed Hall from Binghamton. Did I tell you about that?
I think so.
Yeah. About sponsoring a bill to bring the boys all home for Christmas. Well, now, who wants to sponsor a bill like that? You sponsor a lot of private bills. You sponsor a lot of private bills, sure, for anybody from your district. I had a fellow, a Greek who was a conductor of an orchestra, a very well-known Greek he was, and a well-known conductor, and he was conductor of the Washington, they got up at Watertown, Symphony Orchestra or something there, and he was very well known, a very fine man, to give him citizenship, see. And they went into it very thoroughly, and they They have a special section, Judiciary Committee, that does that. And they questioned him, and they knew he was honest, and they passed a bill. Afterwards, he sent me that beautiful, I didn't ask him, he was a nice guy, but after it was all over, I got this package, and it was a beautiful Grecian urn that we keep in the front there with our flowers in. Mm-hmm. So the picture, it painted, had a picture of the Acropolis on it. Mm-hmm. Oh, you sponsor a lot of private bills. But the big bills, you take a Ways and Means Committee, Wilbur Mills is the chairman. Mm-hmm. Well, he sponsors a bill that goes, the tax bill is going to the Ways and Means Committee, and that is, it's got a chance. If you take an ordinary fellow who wasn't on that committee sponsoring the tax bill, he wouldn't see the light of day. There's about 10,000 bills introduced every session, and 9,000 of them never see the light of day at all. They just put them in to, presumably, the effect back home, or they might be perfectly honest and think it's going to do something, some way of bringing it to the attention of somebody that can get something done.
Did you ever feel frustrated by this, or are many congressmen frustrated by this point? They really can't do that much directly?
Oh, I don't think so, because I don't see how you could have any system that, you see, the Congress works very slowly,
mm-hmm.
and you're frustrated by that sometimes, but on the other hand, it's probably a good thing in the long run, because you pass a law, well, it's a law then, and they've got to go into it very carefully, so that when you pass out a law, it has to come out of committee. The thing that frustrates you is, for instance, this crime bill down there right now. Manny Seller doesn't want it, so he's sitting on it. They've got to force him to get that thing out of there. And, of course, crime is terrible in this country, and they ought to have it out of there to correct some of these terrible decisions of the Supreme Court. And did you see where those four bombers out in Wisconsin?
Mm-hmm.
You read about them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they got them right away, just in 2 or 3 hours, but they couldn't hold them until they got enough evidence. So they had to let them go, and of course they skipped. And in a day or two, they had enough evidence to have held them. Well, they had let them go because of a decision of the Supreme Court. That's what's frustrating about it.
What were the Supreme Court decisions that angered you while you were in Congress?
Well, a lot of their decisions did, but I'm not a lawyer, and it just seemed to me that they were, it got sort of to me anyway, that they, when Warren Court was in there, that all you had to do was go before any court and say, I'm a member of the Communist Party and I'm a crook. So they let you off. You say you're a hard-working, honest American, well, boy, you were socked. It just seemed that way to me on every decision. And a lot of them were just bunk for the reason they'd be 5-4 decisions. Some of them would be 4-4-2, and some were 4-3-1 or something, see? So they, so-called great minds, couldn't decide what was the right decision either, see? They were human. But a lot of them were so anxious to be liberals that they'd forget the decent people.
Mm-hmm. Would you consider yourself a conservative? How would you rate yourself?
Yes, I'd consider myself conservative. Yeah, and they consider me that then.
Were you at any time in the majority among the House of Representatives? You know, was
the Republicans in majority? Yes, we had this. Joe Martin was Speaker in 1946, I think it was, and. Well, Joe was the only Republican speaker when I was there. Seems though he came back once too, for one term.
Did you ever feel that conservatives like yourself were ever in the majority?
No.
Do you think you accurately represented your district as a conservative?
I thought so.
do you think McEwen's as conservative as you are, or?
Well, I think he's conservative. When you say conservative, you got it's a relative term. He's,
right.
I voted against a great many bills down there that I thought were spending too much of the taxpayers' money. Now, that's my idea of a conservative. You go to a Democrat, just I went to Abe Mulder once and said, Abe, how can you vote to spend that much money? You know it's going to be wasted. And he said, well, we Democrats are the spenders, that's all. It didn't come out of their pocket, so they don't care.
So for that reason, you took the stand you did on foreign aid?
Well, I voted for the foreign aid for quite a while till I thought that they put Europe on their feet again, foreign aid did,
mm-hmm.
after the war, and they rebuilt it up so that Germany's twice as good well off as we are.
You didn't look that way.
Yeah, what's the use of spending any more money of our taxpayers' money on foreign aid? Foreign aid was never heard of before this thing came in. But there were a lot of places that were devastated and they were down and out and everything, and this very kind country and generous country gave them money. Well, if they don't, a lot of them have more money and less debt than we had. Why give them any more? Or quit.
You give us
one. Yeah. While you had seniority on the banking and currency, did you ever sponsor bills?
Yeah.
Such as?
Well, we didn't sponsor bills in that committee unless we generally throw in a bill. It wasn't just like that. You'd sponsor a bill, but before you sponsored it, you'd try to find out if it had any chance, for one thing. And if it was a good bill, of course. And you generally talk it over with the chairman. And maybe the chairman would say, well, I'll sponsor it. That'd be a better chance to get it through. I never sponsored anything just to get a vote, no, in my district. I would go along or say, well, if you make this change in the law or do this or something like
that. Did you ever get any insulting letters from this district? People who thought your stand was completely wrong and were very...
Surprisingly enough, very, very few. Very few. And then from some crackpot. I don't suppose I'd get 5 a year.
What were your letters mainly like?
Well, they'd just generally about a passport or they'd be for legislation or not. But as I told you, this district isn't a great letter-writing district. And, of course, the member...
Okay.
Encouraged letters. And I didn't discourage them, but they might send out a bunch of questionnaires, you see. Well, they'd get a lot of letters back. And to my mind, the questionnaire business didn't amount to a pinch of snuff. Because these people would get a questionnaire, they wouldn't know anything about what the legislation was or what it contained. And you might be able to get a picture of a big broad thing that they'd read about in the newspapers, and that would be accurate. But the questionnaires they'd send out, I saw that we had one fellow down there named Perkins Bass from New Hampshire. On our committee, and he sat there every committee meeting. He'd bring in his stack of answers to questionnaires and go through those questionnaires. Talk about a waste of time. So I never got, well, that encourages letter writing. So he gets a lot of mail, see, and a lot of them like to talk about their mail. A lot of them would say, well, they're getting a lot of mail. Well, George Caffrey, my secretary, he knew the post office people there, how much mail everybody was getting, so you can tell. It's just a delight to feel.
Did you ever vote against bills knowing that your district would people in your district might lose your votes in your district?
Oh, yes. I mean, I didn't know. I couldn't tell, but...
You suspect.
I voted against the Civil Rights Bill. Mm-hmm. I was the only one from New York State that did.
Were you chairman at that time?
No, no. Oh, that was quite a few. First round of Civil Rights was on. I voted against it. I voted against the last one, too.
Did you get many letters about that?
I got some. I got some editorials against me. I put a statement in the paper, and I didn't get any more. Why I voted against it.
Did you get any letters against your stand from this district?
Oh, yes. You get letters off and on against it, sure. I always tried to answer them politely. Might send a copy of the bill or copy of the report explaining the bill or something. I've done that with a fellow who bawled me out, said he's never going to vote for me. I've always been a Republican. And I voted against some labor bill that he thought was terrible. He was a member of the union and so on. And I sent him, I said, I don't give a damn whether he voted for me or not, but here's the bill. Sent him the bill, and I got another letter back from him about 2 weeks. He didn't understand the bill, and he thought I was dead right. I voted against it, and he wasn't going to support me. He didn't do anything he could to let me. So, I mean, you can't blame the people, because some of these bills are terribly complicated. And the toughest vote is where you've got 55% of the vote is bad, you think, and 45% is good, but you have to vote yes or no. And on balance, why, then of course you get a lot of criticism, no matter which way you vote.
Mm-hmm. Many of congressmen abstain because they just don't want to, they're afraid to vote one way or another?
No. Or you might have a fella that'll just be out on business, but he generally gets up and says, well, I was called away on business. If I'd been president, I would have voted aye or no. Because, no, you can't do that. You can't duck it. You got it. As Truman said, if you can't stand the heat, you got to keep out of the kitchen, that's all.
Were you away very often when bills came up?
I was away quite a lot when bills had come up that you might think, well, he ought to have been there to vote. But before I'd do it, I'd find out if it was going to go through the great big vote, and I thought I had to be away, why then I'd think differently. If it was going to be a close vote, why then I wouldn't be. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people don't understand that. Supposing a bill passes 320 to 25, what difference does it make whether you're there or not, see? And I'd find that out before I'd go away.
You were usually sent around one periodical a year to your constituents, didn't you, on agricultural leaflets?
No, those, everybody does that. That's called farm bulletins. The government gets the agricultural department does that. We have to send them out. But they do that. I did it, sure. Some fellas didn't. But I had one fellow from the heart of New York City. He asked if I had any more farm bulletins. And I said, farm bulletins, down Manhattan. Well, he ran for somebody to trade him or something. And I said, well, no, I haven't got any for that reason. But if you get allocated certain things. Used to be allocated cookbooks, for instance. And the government got out and other things like that. And you'd try to be fair about it. We ran out of farm bulletins. Some of these city boys give them part of their lot and give them to me, and then if it's something to do with the city, why, I'd give them something like that. Mm-hmm.
So you never sent a newsletter or anything like that?
No. Generally speaking, George Caffrey was a newspaper man, as I told you, and he sent all the newspapers things to put in the papers about anything. So that, in effect, was a newsletter. Mm-hmm. Oh, I did send out what I called my, but not for any political reason, Dear Folks, let me mimeograph it. And I'd cover the things in the, that were going on in the house, and I'd cover about our family. But I sent that to really friends, relatives and friends. I don't think we sent out more than 100. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Did you like Truman as a president?
I did at first, and then and some of the things about him I liked, but some of the things I didn't. I thought he was awful good on the decision to drop the atomic bomb. I thought he was awful good on that, because that was a tough decision to make, and he made it correctly, in my judgment. And the people that's what burns you up. I saw the anniversary the other day, the pictures of it, and these people, terrible thing we ever dropped that and everything. Of course, they don't think of the probably 500,000 American lives that it saved. These boys, if they'd had to go in and take Japan from the shore, they weren't fighting on the beaches, the people that say it was a shame to drop it. Boys, that's what burns you. The atomic bomb saved Japanese lives, too. But it saved our boys' lives to beat the band.
Was there much controversy in the House before that was dropped? Was there any?
Nobody knew anything about it.
How about afterward?
Well, I didn't hear any controversy. Who wanted, for fear of saving some Japanese lives, then we crucify our own men, our fighting men.
It wasn't until later that the discussion became about that.
Well, and then that's these do-gooders that don't think about our own men. Mm-hmm. Our own boys have been fighting over there, dying, and it's going to kill an awful lot of them to get in there.
You liked Truman less and less as he stayed.
Well, he did some things that I thought were terrible. Of course, his background wasn't very good, you know. He was started to be a ward healer in St. Louis, or Kansas City, St. Louis. And, for instance, he had a fellow out there in St. Louis that was a crook, a pal of Truman's. And by golly, the Attorney General's office in Washington got him, and they convicted him in the courts. As soon as Truman became president, he fired that attorney general. I mean, he was an underling, an assistant attorney general, who handled the case. He went after upholding the law of the land and got this crook and sent him to jail because he was a pal of Truman's. As soon as he got in, he fired the guy that had, the assistant district attorney general that got him. Now that's pretty bad, in my judgment.
When was the decision finally made to put in the Seaway?
After Eisenhower got in. Nobody, the Democrats, they had the big majorities and everything, and they never put any pressure in to do it. They loved it as a campaign issue, but they'd all say they were for it and everything, but they never did anything about it. As soon as Eisenhower got in, he said he was for it, and he did something.
Did he contact you before he did anything final?
No. He was very nice to me. There was no reason for him to contact me. Mm-hmm. And when I say did something about it, the proper committee, he saw it, the chairman, got the bill in there, and we all worked hard on it, and got a lot of fellows to change their votes and vote for it, and it went through. As you know, we did a lot of work on it. I did a lot of work.
What kind of work would you have to do on that?
Well, you'd go around and see the fellows that you knew back of the rail you were good friends with, and ask them if they could. Of course, I wanted it for my district, and it was a good thing with the president behind it, and hoped they'd back up the president, and so on and so forth. And you'd get out the right kind of publicity, we thought, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Did you find Eisenhower the best president you worked under?
Well, I liked him the best. Johnson was very nice to us. Kennedy was too. They're all nice to you, you know, but Eisenhower's, I told you, the first one that ever had a group down there for lunch. Every couple of weeks he'd have a group of 60, 70 members of the House, Republican or Democrat, to make a difference. And that's the first time any of them had ever been to the White House for lunch. A lot of Democrats had never been there. 20 years of Democrats had never been to the White House for lunch. He just got acquainted with them. Now, Johnson had a little different idea, and his was better than the previous ones. Now, Eisenhower didn't do as well as Johnson on his congressional night. They always have a congressional reception, you know. Well, I could tell you some stories about that. But Roosevelt, when he was in there, had the regular congressional receptions, which they had always had. See,
what were they like?
Well, they were terrible. You'd get all dressed up in white tie and tails, go down there and stand in line forever, and do a line moving like that, and you'd meet the president, Mr. President. Then there'd be a fellow there, and you'd go on, and that was it. And you'd go out and get some lemonade or something, and a couple of cakes, and leave. Or mill around, talk to your friends, and so on. But you'd been to the one, they'd had a band, and they'd have something. Eisenhower was a little improvement on that, in that he the first reception we went to, he had to stand in line just and do that. But then afterwards, he had a Mrs. Eisenhower liked Lawrence Welk, so she had Lawrence Welk and his orchestra and singers there, and we all got chairs and invite some more people in that didn't were invited to the reception. And has entertainment, and that was interesting. And you could dance if you wanted to. So, but I thought that Johnson, well, then Kennedy came in, and Kennedy improved on the thing some. He'd go around and talk to people, and his wife would too, Jacqueline, after the formal shaking hands was over with. And I remember I told him that, I had told him that before when he was a senator, that I'd known his wife. As soon as he got married, I told him I knew his wife's father, Black Jack Bouvier, my squad over at Madison Barracks, the war. And he was interested in that and so on. So when we were at the White House reception, I saw him for a minute, and he called over. He said, "Jackie, come here." He said, "Mr. Kilburn used to know your father." And we talked about that for a while. So that was that, but Johnson did the best. I thought ran in the best in several ways. Well, to go back to one, Roosevelt had, he invited a group of members of Congress, not all of them, because you couldn't handle them all, but say 80 or 100, in the evening at 8 o'clock, see, informal. And he'd have beer and donuts and stuff like that. See?
Roosevelt?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the Democrats, of course, were in charge of everything, but the fellas, Bob Ramspeck, who was a great friend of mine, a Democrat, he was high up in their thing and an awful nice guy. And he'd heard about 15 or 20 every round. Of course, Roosevelt had to be seated all the time, and he's seated, and to visit with the presidents. They'd kid a little bit and ask questions and so on. And I remember Ham Fish was then the congressman from Roosevelt's district. He's a Republican, of course. They were at sword's point all the time. And of course, Roosevelt was a master at trying to be awful nice to everybody. And he was kidding somebody, and it was another fellow down in Wisconsin. He was an awful good, Dick Gale. He was a Republican, he's an awful good guy. And we were all, the Democrats come up and said, and we'd talk, or a group would talk to him for a little while, and then they'd kind of move out, and then move another group in, not formally, but you'd just stand there. And Roosevelt was just talking off the cuff, and he said, "Well, I'm having," he said, "I'm having a lot of trouble with my ration tickets or something. Rationing." He said, "He's kidding about it," as if he was an ordinary citizen. So he made out his own tax return and all that stuff, which is like Johnson turning off the electric lights in the White House. Save money. The next day, he'd sign a $3 billion bill. I mean, that's just all politics stuff. But Roosevelt said he was having trouble with the ration tickets. And he said, "You fellas have trouble." "Oh, yes, they got a lot of letters about that." The one that Dick Gale spoke of, "Mr. President, if you're having trouble, why don't you write your congressman?" That was ham-fisted. And that, old Roosevelt, that tickled him. That was good. Everybody laughed and beat the man. But then when Johnson became in the White House, he had some awful good meetings there. He wouldn't try to have them all at once. Mm-hmm. And when he did, you'd come in the back door. Before, you'd always come in the front door. You came in the back door, a group of, oh, probably 100, or would their wives be 200, see. And he'd circulate with you, and meet you circulating around, meet everybody. And then when you had your dinner, why, he'd have the wives all go, and his wife would take them all upstairs all over the White House, while he had the men go in the big ballroom, and he'd have McNamara or the Secretary of the Armed Forces there. Was
Clifford?
No, not Clifford. Later. He was later.
Oh.
He'd have Rusk,
yeah,
or McNamara. He had a little podium there, and he'd have the men all sit down in the chairs, and they'd talk to him. Two or three of his cabinet members would talk to the members of the House for, 45 minutes. I mean, that would last, and then the wives come down and meet and say goodnight. But he had one awful good party there in the White House, which was he had a cookout, and he presidential office wing, that's on the west side. There's a big roof over that wing, and it was a nice day. And he'd sent to Texas and gotten a special cook down there. And he had these steaks, individual steaks, and corn, baked potatoes, according to Cobb, baked potatoes, and stuff all cooking there. And you'd go around casually and, "But how do you want your steak?" Tell them just how you want it. You made it just like right off your thing. You take your plate and sit down anywhere you want to, inside or out, and eat it. And that was quite a party. That was good.
Which of the presidents did you know best of all personally?
Well, I didn't know any of them very well. Johnson, I was dumbfounded at him. See, he was in the House when I first went there.
Right.
And this time when he was circulating around, why, he came up to me and he said, "Well, Huck Clarence, how are you? I'm glad to see you again," or something like that. And I looked at him and I said, "How in hell did you remember my name?" "Why," he said, "we were in the House together." Well, he must have been, because we weren't that close. But, but I handed it to him for doing it. It made you feel as if you're amounted to something, you know. When you know better. I remember on that Roosevelt beer, when he asked down for beer and to visit around, one funny thing happened. There was a fellow named Joe Baldwin in the House. He's a Republican from New York. He had a big spread on Life magazine about him, going to the opera in New York. He was quite a society guy in New York. And he was awful, a lot of fun. He was a lot of fun. A lot of guys didn't like him because he voted very liberal. And he'd come and he'd be always dressed up to beat the band. He'd have a collar and this latest stuff, you know. But he was an awful lot of fun. And he went to Harvard He was quite a guy at Harvard. And this big society business, you see, well, he said to me, he said, "You going to the White House?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, I'll pick you up." So we were sitting there waiting for him at 8 o'clock. They said, "The car's down here for you." So I go down. And here's Joe sitting in the corner of his limousine in the back seat. The chauffeur's there. And I get in and I say, "What's the matter with you? You're like grumpy." He said, "Well, I am." He said, "What kind of a party is it? 8 o'clock in the evening, informal." He said, "I always put on my dinner clothes at dinner time." And he says, "Have beer and donuts or something." And how the other half lives, you see, that was all it was. Mm-hmm. But it was kind of a music I told Ann about. On the other hand, he could do things that were awful funny. He'd go up our apartment several times, and he could write with his feet. He could, and good too. He'd put a pencil between his toes like that. He'd take off his shoe and sock, and get a pencil, and he'd write like that. He was quite an artist too.
Could he draw with his feet too?
No, well, he'd draw some with his feet. It was the darndest thing you ever saw, and he had more fun. They had an article in the New Yorker about him, a profile. Remember the profiles in the New Yorker magazine?
Yeah.
They had a profile on Joe Baldwin. And as soon as he got it, as soon as the magazine, of course he knew it was coming out, he came over to me. I was sitting in the house there, and he came over to the New Yorker, and he said, "Read that." He said, "I want to hear what you got to say about it." And I read it. It was awful funny. When he volunteered when he was 18 for the First World War. Mm-hmm. And he was just in the infantry, see. And they shipped him on board with all these common people. And he wrote back to his folks, and he said, "This voyage has done me a lot of good." He said, "It'll take 25 yards of lace off my pants." And he worked his way up to be a captain.
What district did he represent?
Silk Stocking District, New York.
Fifth Avenue?
No, it's you can't tell about the districts. They always call it the 17th, I think, the Silk Stocking District. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's got some nice places, and it's got some slums in it, too. So.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any reason to travel more up to this part of the country when they were building the Seaway, or just about to build it?
Well, they had a couple of opening things up there. Governor Dewey came up and opened the first site where they were going to build the first thing, and I came up for that. They asked me to. Well, and then, of course, I came up for the dedication of Snell Lock because I made the speech there. Mm-hmm. They asked me to make the speech there. Oh, I came up off and on, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What date was the formal opening? What did you do on that day, the formal opening of the whole Seaway?
Well, that was the date to, of course, the President Eisenhower came up. Wait, the one that I made a speech, I was dedicating the Snell Lock. I wasn't dedicating the Seaway.